my shoulder, lingering, his tongue tasting my skin, which was likely salty from sweat. I reached up and buried my fingers in his hair, holding him against me for a moment, and then twisting my neck so our mouths collided. Our teeth clacked together, and normally we would have drawn back and laughed, but neither of us was in a laughing mood. I pulled at his hair, and his hands tightened around my hips so hard it was just on the good side of painful. I had buried myself in rage since the destruction of the Sojourn ship, and since the illusions between him and me fell away. Now I buried myself in wanting him instead, twisting into him, grabbing his body wherever my hands found purchase. "Want me," I told him with each clutch of my fingers. "Choose me. Want me." I leaned back for just a moment, just to look at him. The straight line of his nose and its scattered freckles. His skin was the color of sandstone, and the powder people used to keep their skin from shining, and the envelopes my mother had used to send letters. His eyes were insistent on mine, their color exactly like a storm rolling in over Voa, carrying in them the same apprehension, like even now he was afraid I might stop. I understood. I was afraid I might stop, too. So I pressed into him again, before I could. We stumbled together toward one of the rooms, stumbled out of our shoes. I yanked a curtain across the space exposed to the courtyard, but really, I didn't care if anyone saw. I didn't care if we were interrupted. I just wanted to take and take and take whatever he would give, knowing that this might be the last time I let myself.
Chapter 25. Sizi. The Hall of Prophecy, where I go to meet the Ogryn Oracle, is big and grand, like its name suggests. It's about what I expect, since that's what the hall in Hesse Temple is like, and I used to go visit Mom at work all the time. The Ogryn space isn't as colorful as Hesse's, though. The walls are paneled with dark wood. Carved and etched into the wood are elegant designs that take the shape of what I assume are Ogryn plants. They look almost like they are writhing and snapping right in front of me. There are windows near the ceiling, untinted, that must be lit from outside, because they glow with a light that's not natural to Agra itself. The room itself is narrow and long, with sculptures about an arm span away from each other. Some of them are as carefully shaped as the carvings on the walls, and others are hard and grotesque, but all have a kind of menace to them. Most things on Agra do. The Oracle herself stands in front of one of the sculptures, one of the taller ones, made of metal plates that arc toward the ceiling and twist around each other. They're all polished on one side, and raw on the other, and fastened to each other with big bolts the size of my fist. The Oracle's hands are folded in front of her. Her Oracle robes are a deep, rich blue, and she's barefoot, stouter than Mom, and smaller. She glances at me and offers me a smile. "Sizi Karaseth," she says. "My name is Vara. Come, look at this." I smile back and stand next to her, looking up at the sculpture. I only do it out of politeness. I'm no good at looking at art. "This sculpture was constructed about 30 seasons ago, when the city of Poko began to expand. People were angry that we were losing some of what they called Ogryn humility. The traditional Ogryn belief is that our planet humbles us, reminds us that there are some things we cannot overcome." Vara shrugs. "Some things we should not try to control." She gives me a pointed look. I'm not sure what to make of it. My instinct is to calm her. I try water, the most useful of my textures, but I can tell it doesn't do much to her. What makes Ogryn's comfortable, I wonder? Wind, the warmth of a fire, the softness of a blanket? I sift through a few in my mind before finding one I think seems right. The feeling of cool glass under your palm. Vara raises an eyebrow. I have often wondered what that felt like, she says. It is a heady thing to be touched by your gift. It is all too easy to succumb to its influence. I am sorry, I say. I don't mean to... Vara rolls her eyes. Come on, girl. You can fool people who don't know you that well. But I, along with every other oracle in my generation, have been seeing visions of you from birth. I know that your control is far more advanced than most who can influence their own gifts. I also know that you are trying to do good when you use it against people. So let's talk about Ise Benezit, Sisi. The way she lays it all bare makes me feel jumpy, and all the words I could say to defend myself get stuck in my throat. I nod because that's all I can do to show her that I heard what she said. Do you truly care about her? She asks. Or are you just manipulating her to accomplish your own aims? My aims? I choke out. Yes, I know you are only doing what you think is best, but the fact is, you are making decisions about the future of this galaxy unilaterally, so they are your aims, and no one else's. I don't like to think of what I'm doing with Issei as manipulation. It's not that simple. If only Vara knew how much Issei worried me sometimes. How easy it was for her to kill Rezak and order an attack on Innocence and Voa. How wild her eyes are when she lets herself disappear into anger, and how settled she seems when I draw her back. She needs me. Which gets me back to Vara's original question of whether I really care about her. I do care for her, I say. I love her, but I worry for her. In a fair world, she would have space to feel her grief, but we don't really have the time to let her work out what she's going through on her own, not with a war going on. Vara purses her wrinkled lips. Perhaps you are right, she says. In that case, I must tell you to be careful of the one I've seen in some of your futures. The mechanics boy? Asked. He senses current gifts, doesn't he? I say. He always seems to know when I'm using mine, even if I'm being really careful. It seems that way, Vara says. And he's getting more and more suspicious of you, and more angry that Issei is not suspicious, I think. I nod. Thank you for the warning. Be careful, girl, Vara says, catching my hand and squeezing it tightly. A little too tightly. Her pupils are big. Most Ogryns are, since there is so little light everywhere. But I can see a slim green ring around them that makes up her irises. And don't trust the Otherians. She squeezes still harder. Don't let her agree to it. Whatever you do. I'm not sure what she means, but I know she wants me to nod. So I do.
Chapter 26, Akos. It was late that night that the Oracle finally asked for him, or rather them, because she wanted to see him and Syra at the same time. Earlier they had fallen asleep, tangled up in each other, with light from the plants and the garden casting a soft glow through the curtain Syra had drawn. The silver skin on one side of her head had been cool against his chest, where she insisted on laying to listen to his heartbeat. He didn't know what had come over him in the garden, pulling her close when he knew it was selfish, that he couldn't give her what she wanted at her own insistence. He ought to listen to her, maybe even break things off with her completely, because there was no ridding him of his fate and no way of convincing either of them that things would be the same if he didn't have death in service to her family to look forward to. But the longing for her had pierced right through the haze that had settled over his mind the past few weeks, and he was too relieved at feeling something that he hadn't had the heart to suppress it. And he'd gone on wanting her, even while they struggled closer and closer, like there just wasn't enough of her and never would be. He couldn't take her hand as they walked. It would only attract the beetles, and he wasn't eager to have one of them perched on his face again. But he stayed close so he could almost feel her. Her current shadows were moving faster, darting across her throat and disappearing under her collar. And he wished he could do more for her than the mediocre painkiller he had given her before they left. Perry led them to the top of the hill, but not to the large hall lit bright from within. Down to the lower level of the place, where the ceiling sloped too close to the top of his head for comfort, and the floorboards creaked with every step. He had to bend to pass through a doorway, and found himself in what looked like a kitchen. A woman not much older than his own mother stood there, her hands buried in a pile of dough. Her arms were freckled, and her hair was gray and curly, cut short around her head. She smiled up at them when they walked in, with all the warmth he'd learned not to expect from oracles, who always seemed disconnected and harsh to him, even the falling oracle of Thuva before his death. "Syra, Akos, welcome," she said. "Please sit." She gestured to the bench across the table from her. Akos did as she said, but Syra stayed on her feet, arms crossed. "Would you feel more comfortable with busy hands?" she asked Akos. "I know you have an affinity for making elixirs. There's plenty here to chop." "No," he said, his face flushing with warmth. "Thank you." "Do you have a name?" Syra asked, blunt as ever. "Or should we just call you Oracle?" "Ah, forgive my rudeness. My name is Vara," she said. "I sometimes forget that people I know do not know me in turn. Is there anything I can do to make you less hostile, my dear?" She nodded to Syra. "Or are you content to remain this way?" A faint crease appeared in Syra's cheek, the way it did when she was suppressing a smile. "Fine, I'll sit," she conceded. "But don't read too much into it." "I wouldn't dare," Vara said as Syra perched on the edge of the bench next to Akos. Even sitting down, the two of them were taller than Vara, who was short and thick through the middle. There was something familiar about her. "Are you related to Issa in some way?" he asked. "Well spotted, darling, yes. She is my daughter. A rather late-in-life entanglement it was," she said. "She gets her father's frame, tall and long-limbed. The rest was mine." She broke a piece off the dough and popped it in her mouth. "Now," she said as she swallowed, "I'm sure you are wondering why I didn't put on my traditional Ogryn robes and meet you in the Hall of Prophecy like a proper oracle." "It crossed my mind," Akos said. "I would expect no less from the son of an oracle," Vara said, still with that kind smile. "Well, really, let's keep this between us, but I hate that hall. It makes me feel short. So do the robes. They were made for the last oracle, and he was much bigger than me. Besides, I thought, given the nature of what I have to discuss with you both, you might appreciate the more comfortable surroundings." Akos felt like he'd been dunked in cold water suddenly. "Given the nature of what I have to discuss with you." "So it's not good news," Syra said, wry, leaning on sarcasm almost always meant she was scared out of her mind. The tightening of her hands around the edge of the bench suggested the same thing. Vara sighed. Oh, the truth rarely is, dear girl. What I have for you today is something we call kirta. Do either of you know the word? Syra and Akos both shook their heads. Of course not. Who speaks Ogryn but Ogryns? Vara's laugh was like a thin trickle of water. You see, we think of oracles as delivering the future only, and that's most of what we do, yes. She grabbed a fat metal cylinder from a shelf behind her and used it to roll the dough flat. But it's the past that brings about the future. Often it stays hidden, shaping our lives in ways we do not understand, but sometimes it must force its way into the present in order to change what's coming. She broke the dough into three large pieces and rolled them between her hands until they were long and thin, like tails. Then she began to braid them. Kirta, she said, is a revelation that causes your world to shift on its axis. It is a profound truth that, once you know it, inevitably alters your future, though it has already occurred and should, therefore, change nothing. She finished the braided dough and set it aside with a sigh. Dusting off her hands, she sat down across from them and leaned into her arms. In your case, this kirta comes in the form of your names, she said. You have lived your lives as Akos Kereseth and Syra Noavik, when in fact, you are Akos Noavik and Syra Kereseth. She sat back from the table. Akos struggled to breathe. Syra let out a peal of laughter.
Chapter 27 Syra. I clapped my hand over my mouth to stop the sound. A horrible, forced laugh without any mirth in it. Syra Kereseth. It wasn't the first time I'd ever thought the name. I had daydreamed about it once or twice, leaving the name Noavik behind and taking on Akos's name, someday in an ideal future where we got married. It was customary for the lower status person in a marriage to change their name in Shotet, but we could make an exception to rid me of the label I hated. The name Syra Kereseth had become, to me, a symbol of freedom, as well as a sugar-sweet unreality. But Vara didn't mean that my name was Syra Kereseth through some hypothetical, far-off marriage. She meant that my name was Syra Kereseth now. The hard part was not believing I wasn't Syra Noavik. I had suspected it since my brother told me I didn't share his blood. Maybe even since my blood didn't work in the gene lock that he had used to keep his rooms secure. But believing I belonged to the same family that had raised Akos to a soft heart and a knowledge of ice flowers, that was another thing entirely. I didn't dare look at Akos. I wasn't sure what I would see when I did. I took my hand away from my face. What? I said, stifling another giggle. What?
Sifa would tell the story better, Vara said. But unfortunately, that task now falls to me, because it is Agra's future that hangs in the balance. When you were born, Akos, to Ilira and Lazmet Noavik, Sifa saw only dark paths ahead of you. And likewise, Syra, born to Sifa herself and Ausa Kereseth, only dark paths ahead of you. She despaired for both of you. And then something happened that had not happened in quite some time. A new possibility presented itself. If she crossed your paths, if she switched your places, new possibilities opened up, and a few, very few, mind you, but a few, did not lead to doom. So she reached out to Ilira Noavik, a woman she had never met before and would never again meet. to present the solution to her. It was very fortunate for her that Lazmet had not yet been to see his child. It was likewise fortunate that the bloodlines in both your families are so richly varied that virtually any combination of features and skin shades wouldn't raise eyebrows. They met just past the divide, the feather grass that separates Xotet from Thuva, and they traded their children so that both might have a chance to avoid their darkest paths, Vara said, with a tone of finality. Her fingers were dusted with brown flour, her nails bitten down to stubs. Lazmet was told that he had been misinformed about the sex of his child. The messenger who had delivered the news was executed, but Lazmet accepted you as his, Syra, and all proceeded as Sifa had hoped.
I was caught in my imagining of the moment. My swaddled, infant form passed into Alira Noavek's hands, with feather grass swaying in the background. I drew myself out of the fiction, suddenly furious.
So you're telling me, I said, slumping forward over the table to point a finger at her. You're telling me that my mother handed me over to be raised by a bunch of monsters, and I'm, what, supposed to be grateful because it was for my own good? It's not up to me to tell you how to feel, Vara said, her dark eyes soft. Only to tell you what happened.
I felt like a pot boiling over, all anger and hysteria bubbling up inside me. Irrepressible. I wanted to shake the soft look from her eyes or laugh in her face. I wanted to move above all else, to escape the pain that now raced through every izzet of my skin, covering me in dark patches. When I finally dared to glance at Akos, I saw him stone-faced and completely still. It was unnerving.
I'm sure I don't have to point out to you that there is one bright spot in all this, Vara said. Your fates.
Our fates, I repeated, feeling stupid. What about them?
There is a reason the fates don't name names, Vara said. The second child of the family Noavek will cross the divide. The third child of the family Karaseth will die in service to the family Noavek. My dear girl, you are the third child of the family Karaseth. And I suspect your fate has already been fulfilled.
I made a big show of putting two fingers against the side of my throat to check for a pulse.
Silly me, thinking I hadn't died in service.
I cut myself off. But that wasn't true, was it? My brother had tried to make me torture Akos there in the underground prison where he had captured us and forced us to our knees. I had drawn all my current gift into myself, trusting in my strength to keep me alive. But that strength had faltered, just for a moment, just enough to be considered a death. My heart had stopped, and then started again. I had come back. I had died for the family Noavek. I had died for Akos. I stared at him, wonderingly. The fate he had dreaded, the fate he had allowed to define him since he first heard it spoken by my brother's lips. It was mine. And it was done.
Chapter 28, Akos. All the things that he was, fated traitor, Karaseth, Thuvazit, had been stripped away. He hadn't said a word since the Oracle invited them to share a cup of tea with her and Syra declined. The truth was, he'd lost all his words. He didn't even know which language he ought to speak in. The categories he'd used to define them, Thuvazit, the language of his home and his people, Othir, the language of off-worlders, Shotet, the language of his enemies, didn't apply anymore. Cyrus seemed to know that he couldn't speak. Maybe she didn't understand it, and how could she? She had lit up like a piece of kindling when Vara told them the truth. She was emotionally elastic, could throw herself out of rage just as fast as she could throw herself into it. But even though she didn't understand him, she didn't pester him either. All she had done was touch him, tentative, on the shoulder, as she said, "I know. I didn't want to share blood with them either." And that was it, wasn't it? She shared a history with the Noavix, and he shared blood. He was hard-pressed to figure out which one was worse. He didn't sleep, just walked the paths around the temple, not even bothering to avoid the dangerous plants that were growing everywhere, or the beetles that could kill him with a bite. He didn't recognize most of the growing things, but some of them he did, and he looked for them just to give himself something else to think about for just a little while. The beetles came and went, except for one, a small one that perched on his hand, twitching its light-up wings and wiggling its antennae. He sat on a rock in one of the gardens to stare down at it. It reminded him, for some reason, of the armored one he had killed for its skin. He had been out there in the fields outside of Voa, where the armored ones wandered, keeping to themselves for the most part. It had taken him a while to realize they weren't going to attack him. It was the current that enraged them, not him. He was a relief to them, just like he was to Syra. Maybe this beetle was the same, avoiding those who channeled the current because the energy was too harsh for it to stand. The pattern on its back was like spilled ink, taking no particular shape. It lit up blue-green when it did light up, a soothing color. After some time, the prickle of the little clinging legs didn't bother him, and neither did the threat of its substantial pincers. It was a little monster, just like him. It couldn't help how it was born. The Oracle's revelation was like a crumpled piece of paper that just kept unfolding more and more. First it showed him the things he wasn't anymore, and then it showed him the things he was. A Shotet. A Noavik. The man who had taken everything from him, father, family, safety, and home, had been his brother. And the man who had made Rizek, Lazmet, he was Akos's father. Still alive, still so alarming to Syra, unshakable, unfaltering Syra, that she had panicked at the sight of his face alone. "What do I do now?" he asked the beetle on his hand. "Surely that thing won't respond to you," Perry's voice said from behind him. "I don't claim to understand other people's current gifts, though." Akos whipped around fast. The beetle on his hand still didn't stir, thankfully. "Don't come much closer," he said. "Killer beetles and all." "They seem to like you," Perry said. "Whatever you are is a very strange thing." Akos nodded. That wasn't up for debate. Perry stood in front of him, at a safe distance, with his hands in his pockets. "She must have told you something difficult." Akos wasn't sure difficult was the right word for it. The beetle crawled from his thumb to his sleeve, pincers clicking audibly. Hopefully that wasn't what it did before it attacked. Akos didn't think it was going to attack him, though. "There are a lot of people across the solar system who think oracles are elitist, you know," Perry said, "only giving fates, and therefore importance, to certain families. It seems like an unnecessary display of favoritism to people who don't understand how fates work, how they do not allow an oracle to choose anything at all. But those who have fates know better." Perry's eyes glinted with the glow of a flower in the garden, reflecting orange. "A fate is a cage," he said. "Freed from that cage, You can choose, do, go, whatever, wherever you'd like. You can, in some ways, finally know who you are. Akos had been too busy thinking about who he was related to think about fates, though he knew that's where Syra's mind had gone. Maybe he ought to be happy that he wasn't fated to die anymore. But he'd been hanging on to that so hard that it was hard to adjust. It was like he'd been carrying a weight around for so long he forgot what it was like to be without it. And now he felt too light, like he might float away. And his true fate? The second child of the family Noavec will cross the divide. Well, he'd already done that. Crossed the stretch of feather grass that separated Thuva from Shotet. He'd done it more than once, so his fate had been fulfilled. And now, Perry was right. He could choose whatever, do whatever, go, wherever he wanted, wherever he needed to go. A decision was just coming together in his mind when he heard the scream, high and grating. A wail joined it, and then a low shout. Three voices raised in acknowledgement of pain. Three oracles. By now he knew what it meant. There had been another attack. The beetle fled from his wrist as he ran up the hill to the room where his brother slept. He ripped the sheer curtains aside to see Iger sitting up in bed, his fingers knotted in his curly hair as he moaned. It had been a long time since Akos had seen Aegis so rumpled, his shirt twisted around his torso and half his face marked by the crease of a pillowcase. Akos hesitated at the edge of the room. Why had he come here? Instead of going to his mom's room. He'd lost the parts of Aegis he'd been so determined to save, and now he knew that what was left of Aegis wasn't even related to him anyway, so what kept drawing him back? Aja lifted his head, eyes locking on Akos's face. Our father, Aja said. He's attacking them. Aja, Akos said. You're confused. Our father is... Lazmet, Aja said, rocking back and forth, still clutching his head. Shisa. He attacked Shisa. How many dead? Akos touched Aja's shoulder and his brother. His brother pulled away. No, don't. I need to see. How many? Akos demanded, even though deep down he knew it didn't matter whether it was a handful or dozens or hundreds. Aja said, it's raining glass. Then Aja burst into tears and Akos sat on the edge of the bed. No, it didn't matter that it was hundreds. His path forward remained the same.
Chapter 29 Aja. You have to find ways to ground yourself, Sifa said to us, or the visions will take over. You'll get stuck in all the possibilities, and you won't be able to live a life. We answered, would it be so bad? To live 1,000 different lives instead of your own? She narrowed her eyes at us, this woman who was our mother, an oracle, and a stranger all at once. We had ordered the death of her husband. We had suffered the loss of that man ourselves. How odd it was to be responsible for so much pain, and to have suffered as a direct result of that responsibility all at once. As our identities melded more and more, we felt more profoundly the contradictions inherent in our being. But there was nothing to be done about it. The contradictions existed and had to be embraced. Whatever made you for a purpose, she said. And it wasn't to become a vessel for other people's experiences. It was to have your own. We shrugged, and that's when the images came. We are in the body of a man, short stocky and standing before a cart full of books. The smell of dust and pages is in the air, and shelves tower above him. He places a heavy volume on a tray that sticks out from the shelf and keys in a code on a device he carries. The tray zooms off to the shelf where the book is supposed to go, a story above his head and to the left. He sighs and walks to the end of the aisle to look out the window. The city, which we recognize as Shissa in Thuva, is full of buildings that hover so far above the ground that the ice flower fields beneath it look like mere patches of color amid the snow. The buildings appear to be hanging from the clouds themselves. Across the way is a tiered, diamond-shaped structure of glass that glows green at night, lit from within. To its left, a curved mammoth lit up soft white, like the land beneath it. It is a beautiful place. We know it. We are not a man anymore. We are a woman, short and shivering in a stiff vest of Shotet armor. Why does anyone live in this damn country? She says to the man next to her. His teeth are chattering audibly. Ice flowers, the man said with a shrug. She flexes her hands in an attempt to bring feeling back to her fingers. Shh, he says. Up ahead, a Shotet soldier has her ear pressed to a door. She closes her eyes for a moment, then pulls back, and motions the others forward. They slam a metal cylinder into the door, several times to force it open. The lock pops off and clatters to the cement floor. Beyond the door is a control room of sorts, like the nav deck of a transport vessel. A scream pierces the air. We rush forward. We are standing at a window, one hand pressed to cold glass, the other pulling a curtain back. Above us is the city of Shissa, a cluster of giants that drape over us always. It has been our colorful comfort in the night ever since we were a child. The sky without buildings in it seems bare and empty, so we do not like to travel. Since we have been staring at them, the buildings do not move, not even in the strongest wind. That is thanks to the Pithar technology that holds them upright, controlled by small towers on the ground near the ice flower fields. We don't understand how it works. We are a field worker. The boots, with hooks on the bottom to catch on ice sheets, are still on our feet from the day's labor. Our shoulders still sore from hauling equipment. As we watch, the hospital, a bright red cube right above us, shifts, shudders, and drops. It falls, pulling a gasp from our lungs, like something dropped into a bucket of water. It seems to move slowly, though that can't be true. It sends snowflakes up in a faint white streak as it drops, and then it collides with the ground. We are a child in a hospital bed. Our body is short and slim. Our hair sticks to the back of our neck. It is hot in here. The rails are up on the side of the bed, like we're some kind of kid and can't be trusted not to roll off in our sleep. The bed jerks beneath us, and we startle, grabbing the rails. Only it's not the bed that's moving. It's the floor. It's falling out from beneath us. The city slides away just outside the windows, and we cling to the rails, teeth gritted, and then we're screaming. The Shotet woman, we, tugs at the straps of her armor as we run. We fasten them too tight, and they're digging into our sides, keeping us from moving as fast as we'd like. The sound as the building falls is nothing like we have ever heard. The crunching, smashing, the screaming, wailing, gasping, the rush of air around it. It is deafening. We clap our hands over our ears and keep running toward the transport vessel, toward safety. We see a dark shape flinging itself off the hospital roof. Our knees are buried in the snow. The man from before is next to us, shouting something we can't hear. Our cheeks are hot. Startled, we realize that the Shotet woman's face is wet with tears. This is the retribution Lazmet Noavek ordered. But it feels more like horror. "Come on," the other soldier is saying. "We have to go." But how can we go when all those people need help? How can we go on when so many are lost? How can we go on?
Chapter 30. Syra. That evening, Akos left to walk the gardens, and I found myself alone. The humid Ogryn air had made my cheeks damp, and I wanted to wash my face. I stumbled to the bathroom, stinging and aching, and leaned my forehead against the tile wall as I turned on the faucet. My fingers always hurt worse than the rest of my body, the current shadows coalescing in my extremities, like they were itching to escape. I splashed my face with water and dried it with the front of my shirt. Syra Karaseth, I thought, trying out the name. It felt false, like I was trying to put on someone else's clothing. But being in this place, where the blankets were still thrown back from where Akos and I had lain tangled together, felt just as wrong. I had been someone else when we rested here, with my ear against his chest. Suddenly I needed to get out, to move. I walked to Perry's ship, on the far side of the hill, away from the gardens, so I wouldn't run into Akos. The ship's hatch opened at the touch of a button, the interior lights on, guiding me to a seat near all the restrained plants of Agra. I was sitting there, in front of the plant that looked like a giant mouth, my head in my hands, when the hatch opened again. I lifted my head, sure it would be Akos, that we could finally talk about what we had heard. But it wasn't. It was Sifa. She didn't close the hatch, so I could still hear the buzz of insects and the whisper of wind while she stood, staring at me. I stared back. The pain that surged through me at the sight of her, at the thought of what she had surrendered me to as a child, was startling. I stayed still to keep it contained. No flinching, no shaking, no moaning. Nothing that invited comfort. I didn't want her to see that she could hurt me. "You spoke to Vara," she said to me at last. I sat up and pushed my braid over one shoulder. "Yeah, thanks for that, by the way," I said, twitching a little at a current shadow racing across my face. "Nothing like the news of your own abandonment coming from a stranger." "You have to know," she began, and then I was on my feet, boots planted on the great floor, a line of guiding light between my feet. "Yes, please, tell me what I have to know," I snapped. "Is it how you felt dumping your own daughter into a family of monsters? Or lying to your son for his entire life? Is it how you did it for the good of Thuva, or Shotet, or the goddamn current? Because yes, that's really all I want to know. How hard this was for you." I felt huge, suddenly, like a wall of muscle. She wasn't frail. She had a certain wiry strength to her. But she was not built like me, solid through the hips and shoulders. I could have knocked her down with a punch, and part of me wanted to try. Maybe it was the part of me that was Noavek, the part that wouldn't have existed if she had kept me safe instead of trading me away. Sifa stayed by the hatch, silhouetted by the lights on the little runway behind her. Her hair was piled on one side of her head, scraggly, like she hadn't combed through it in days. She looked so tired. I didn't care.
What did you see? I said. What did you see in our futures that made you trade us? What could possibly have been so bad that it was better to hand me over to the Noavex than to let me suffer it?
She closed her eyes, face tightening, and I felt cold creeping down my spine.
I am not going to tell you that, she said, opening her eyes. I would rather you hate me than know what I saw become of you, of Akos. I chose the best path for you, the one that had the greatest potential.
You don't have the right, I said in a low voice, to decide my path for me.
I would do it again, she said.
I was thinking about that punch again.
Get away from me, I said.
Syra, no, I said.
Maybe you could determine what happened between us when I was an infant, but you have lost that power.
I stood. As I moved toward the hatch to pass her, her posture changed. She slumped oddly against the doorway, head angled down, hair spilling around her face. And then raised her voice in a harrowing scream. Another vision, then. Something horrible. At first I stood before her, simply listening, her voice scraping at the insides of my head. And then I crouched before her as she slid down the wall to the ground, unwilling to offer comfort, but unwilling to leave without knowing what she saw. It took some time for her to go quiet. The scream stopped with a sound like a gag. I had learned that asking Sifa direct questions rarely resulted in anything productive, so I didn't speak. My current shadows burning across my belly, I waited, hunched there in the dark. Behind me, the mouth plant snapped its brittle jaws. It took so long for her to speak that my legs went numb.
There's been an attack on Shissa, she said, breathless. Courtesy of Lazmet Noavec.
My first thought, though it shamed me a moment later, was, so? Uva had struck us first. Alarming though it was to think of an armed force at my father's command, this was a war, and both sides suffered in a war. But I had not forgotten how I felt when the Sojourn ship broke apart over Voa. Wherever Akos was, he was about to feel the same thing. Despite my anger at our enemies, I couldn't wish this on someone I loved. I left Sifa there, the woman who had given me blood and then given me away. I had no comfort to give her, and no desire to give it. I sprinted down the white stone path to the gardens to find him. But that place was empty, the beetles buzzing undisturbed. So I ran, instead, to the room where we had slept. The bed was empty. I went from room to room, searching out Sisi's bed, empty. But in the room that would have been Sifa's, I found Issa instead. Her red hair clung wetly to her cheeks, as if she had just bathed.
I'm sorry, she said.
For what? The attack? I said. It was a strange thing to apologize to me for.
Attack? She said.
She didn't know yet, then.
What attack?
I shook my head. In a moment. What are you sorry for, Issa? I said, impatient. I need to find Akos now.
That's just it, she replied. He's gone.
I felt like I might burst into flames, like one of the lethal vines in Agra's forests, exploding at a careless touch.
Perry left just a moment ago with Sisi and Akos. They intend to depart Agra on the same vessel that Jorek Kuzar will be on, headed back to Voa, at the break of day, Issa said. They didn't leave word, I said. I wasn't asking. I wish I knew more. Perry didn't tell me anything. I know you must be confused, she said. But I wasn't confused. Perhaps if I had been normal, if I had grown up with any other name, I would have been. Akos had been released of his fate and of his obligation to me. And so he had left. Gone home. Why would he feel the need to leave a message of farewell, or simply of explanation, to Rizek's scourge? That would be too considerate. Too much for a person like me to possibly expect. I sat, heavy, on the trunk that stood at the foot of Sifa's bed. My current shadows ran thick across my skin. He was gone. And I was alone again. 3. Oruzo. Noun. In Shotet, a reflection, as in a mirror. Chapter 31. Syra. Sweat ran into the corner of my mouth. I licked the salt taste away and burst into a run. It was a risk, but I thought I could surprise him with strength he wasn't ready for. My opponent was tall and lean. Etrek, the one who had called me Rizek's Scourge in the Storm Sanctuary when I first arrived, and insisted on the name whenever he saw me. But right now, he was just an arrangement of limbs, a particular density of meat. I threw my body at his, driving my elbows low, toward his gut. The school of the mind, Elmatahak, would not approve of my risk-taking. A risk should only be taken when there is no other option available, the teachings said. In this case, they were correct. I had miscalculated. Etrek's arm slammed like a girder against my chest and shoulder, knocking me flat on my back. All around me, the crowd roared their pleasure. "Bleed, Oruzo!" someone in the crowd jeered. I heard, in their shouts, a memory of kneeling on a platform with a knife against my throat. My brother poised above me with rage and fear intermingled in his eyes. My people calling me traitor. My people crooning for my blood. The silver skin on my head prickled. They still crooned for my blood, even here, on Agra. To them, I was still a Noavek. Still better dead than alive. I looked up at the wall, at Etrek, about to bend down to deliver the final blow. I knew him. He called me ally. He fought me for sport. But deep in the heart of him, he still wanted me to hurt. So I slid a hand behind his head, as tenderly as a lover, and drew him closer. "Hurt me more," the movement said. "Go ahead." He jerked back like my touch was poison. And it was. And he fell back, off balance. I crawled on top of him, pinned him, made to elbow him in the face. But I stopped before striking him, my eyebrows raised.
"Yeah, yeah, I concede," Etrek said, and the crowd booed.
They were tired of watching me win. Tired of watching Noavex win. That Lazmet's blood didn't run in my veins, that I might not technically even be Shotet, didn't matter to them. Did it matter to me? Later, when the leaders of the Shotet exiles asked me to represent my people to the Ogryn leadership, not knowing, of course, that I was not the true inheritor of my brother's throne, I thought of how I had felt
with my back flat on the ground, with those people cheering for my pain and defeat. They hated me. They did not accept me. They didn't want me to represent them.
The more traditional of the two Ogryn leaders values law very highly, and you are the legal heir to the sovereignty, the exile leader, Aza, said to me with a hint of desperation.
Tekka added, "We need your help, Syra." I looked at her, her pale hair limp from Ogryn humidity, a dark circle beneath her remaining eye betraying her fatigue. And suddenly, Shotet was not the nameless crowd that had surrounded me more than once. Shotet was her, and Jorik, and even Ima. People who had been trampled by the powerful, just as I had. People who needed this small thing in order to fight back. And I owed it to them. I had told people to evacuate. I had let slip that the exiles were on Agra. I carried the Noavek legacy, even if I didn't carry their blood. I owed this at the very least, for what I had done. Fine, I said. I look ridiculous, I said to my reflection. Or really, I said it to Tekka, who stood behind me with her arms folded, sucking a dimple into her cheek. I wore a floor-length jacket with sharp shoulders, buttoned tight across my chest and falling straight to the floor. Every seam was stitched with glowing thread, though, which made me feel more like an Ogryn spacecraft than a person. The collar, made entirely of luminous fabric, lit my face from beneath, making my current shadows especially nightmarish when they flowed across my skin. Which was constantly. What little control I had retained when we first landed on Agra was gone, as if Akos had taken it with him when he left.
Aza wanted to make sure you looked the part of a sovereign, even if you're not really one. And now you do, Tekka said. Besides, everyone here looks ridiculous, so you fit right in.
She gestured to herself. She was dressed like me, except her jacket was gray, to complement her coloring, the Ogryn seamstress had said, and fell to her knees instead of her ankles. She wore pants to match it, and her pale hair was pulled back into a sleek knot. My own was in a thick, bumpy braid over one shoulder, on the side opposite the silver skin. We were about to attend a meeting with representatives of Agra in Pokgo, Agra's capital city. They had invited us to discuss the request, more like a demand, issued by the government of Thuva that the Ogryns no longer give shelter to Shotet exiles, in the wake of the attack on Shissa. I felt ill. The only reason Thuva had known to make that demand of Agra was because I had told Issei we were here. My current shadows were dense and quick, and this restrictive clothing wasn't helping. I couldn't deny that it emphasized the length of my body in a nice way, though. "You're going barefaced?" I said to Tekka, turning away from the mirror. "You could at least smudge something on your eye, you know."
"Every time I try, I just end up looking stupid," she said.
"I could give it a try," I said. "My mother taught me when I was young."
"Just don't zing me with your current gift," Tekka said, a little grouchy.
I had found a little black pencil to trace my lash line in one of the shops in Gallo. I had tried to barter with the clever Ogryn woman who ran it, but she had pretended not to understand my accent, so I eventually gave up on the game and bought it for its full price. I removed its cap and stood in front of Tekka, bending so our faces were on the same level. I couldn't brace myself against her, so I braced my hands against each other to steady them.
"We could talk about it, you know," Tekka said. "Him leaving like that? Not so much as a goodbye? We could talk about it if you, you know, needed to."
"Not so much as a goodbye,"
He had decided I wasn't worth that basic decency. I clenched my jaw.
No, I said. We can't.